In many ways, the study of the Holocaust began with attempts to understand the Nazi perpetrators. In fact, the first people to try to do this were Nazi victims themselves during the Holocaust, because this understanding could often mean the difference between life and death. In this difficult conversation, I talked with Professor Ed Westerman about the role alcohol played in enabling Nazi killers. But more than that, we also talked about masculinity and violence, and how to write about the perpetrators. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Holocaust History Podcast. I'm your host, Waitman Bourne. And today, we have a very difficult topic. It's basically looking at perpetrators. And it's based on a book by our guest, Ed Westerman, which has in the title Drunk on Genocide. But I think it covers a lot more than just the role of alcohol the role alcohol played in perpetrator motivation and perpetrator enabling perpetrators to kill and those kinds of things. So I do want to provide sort of a content warning for anybody listening. You know, there are going to be troubling, probably discussions about things like sexual violence as well as extreme violence in general. But also if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are ready for some of that. So without further ado, Ed, how are you? Welcome.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate you having me here, Waitman, and it's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, so can you tell us a little about yourself, where you are, what you do, how you got into, in general, the field of Holocaust studies, and then we can talk a little about sort of the book that you've written.
You bet, yeah. So currently I'm a Regents Professor of History at Texas A&M University, San Antonio, and I kind of took the long and winding road to get to academe. I spent 30 years in uniform in the Air Force. I went through the Air Force Academy and was a pilot for part of that time, and was an exchange pilot actually with the Luftwaffe, the German Air Force, for 3 years. And coming out of that assignment, I wanted to go back and teach at the Air Force Academy. And having the German language, they ended up sending me to work with Alan Steinweis, who was at that time at Florida State, who's now up in Vermont. But I worked on a master's thesis that dealt with the German police organization, and ended up going back to the academy, teaching, and eventually the Air Force sent me for a PhD, and I did a completely different project for my dissertation looking at German anti-aircraft defenses in World War I and World War II, which became my first book. But the second book was on Hitler's police battalions enforcing racial war in the East. That is a kind of macro view at the Ordnungspolizei, or the Order Police, an organization made famous, obviously, by Chris Browning's work on Police Battalion 101. And eventually I retired from the Air Force and was very fortunate to get an academic job, a tenure track position here in San Antonio at the newest A&M affiliate campus, which is A&M San Antonio. So it took a while to get here, but I finally made it.
Well, you know, I mean, we're sort of two of the unicorns in academia, right, that did some military stuff before we made there. So, you know, but I think that, at least in my case, it's also kind of informed what I do. And I think probably and when we talk about this project, I think it probably informed your take on it as well.
Yeah, you bet. I think our lived experience, and, you know, I talk to my students, I think one of the things I've learned from that military experience is the way I look at small unit actions, how I look at organizational culture. You've talked about command climate in your own word, leadership and how leadership influences that culture or that climate. And the way in which men and women, but from the time that I was in, it was largely combat arms were for men only. But the way in which men interact together in flying units, in small units. So I think that that experience definitely informs the way that I look at what happened in Nazi Germany and what I looked at as what happens in paramilitary or military organizations. So I think it's I think it is powerful to have that background. And when I talk to my students about things they want to study, I also ask them, well, what's your kind of lived experience and how might it inform the things that you want to study in your own lives or in your own career? So I think that's a key point.
Yeah, and it's something that to be honest, I there were elements of it that seemed so obvious to me until people who weren't in the military, you know, sort of said something like, you know, you should highlight this thing that you've discovered. And I'm like, but this is so like, who doesn't know this, right? But things that we sort of take, and I think that shows the pluses and minuses, right? And the reason why we need people from all backgrounds to work on any historical topic, right? Because I'm sure that we both bring specialized insights, but probably somebody who doesn't have the experience that we've had can bring other insights that aren't sort of burdened by, you know, any biases that we may have as well, right? So that I think, you know, it's people ask me sometimes, you know, well, in writing the first book, which was about the German army, you know, like how much of your experience sort of informed this book? And, you know, a lot of it did. But I always say, you know, it just gives you a different view. It's not necessarily better or more accurate than you, because somebody else might, again, like I remember, for example, with masculinity, which we'll talk about, you know, one of the people on my dissertation committee sort of said, you know, why aren't you actually explicitly saying in your book, you know, elements about, or in your dissertation, things about masculinity as it relates to criminality? And I was like, I thought that was obvious. You know, like I didn't even think about the fact that I should put that on the page, because I thought it just sounded like I was being, you know, too sort of blatant about it. So yeah, I mean, I think it helps to let us look for things. But then the challenge always from somebody who has sort of an experiential relationship with the topic is to articulate those things, you know, to pull them out of what we think is obvious, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I'll give you just a couple of examples, because I think this is a very important thing to talk about. So in the military, as we both kind of know from our experience, when you meet somebody, one of the things
you're looking... And to be clear, I was in the military for 5 years. So like Ed has a far massively greater experience in the military than I do. So I just want to make it clear that make these two things equivalent. You know, I had sort of a taste of it, you know, so yeah. But anyway, sorry, Ed, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. When we meet people in the military, one of the first things you do is if they're in uniform, if they're in their dress uniform and they're wearing their ribbons and their medals, one of the first things we do in the military is that tells us a lot about that individual, where they've been, what they've done, what they've been involved in. And so when I was writing about the order police, for example, the fact that that Himmler allowed the order police to wear their military decorations from the Imperial Army seems like maybe to some people that's a very minor thing. But when you understand how important those decorations are, or the fact that order policemen could wear the SS runes if they were a member of the SS on their uniform, that, you know, some people might just not see that or might not think the importance of it, but internally, for the individual and the way the individual interacts with their comrades, it's important. And another thing that I think really does help inform the way I looked at this last book is the idea of when you hear stories of, hey, there were bands or music playing when killings are taking place, and these are automatic weapons that are being used, and you see people saying, well, they're trying to drown out the sounds of shooting. Well, these executions in most cases were routine and were not a secret. And if you've been on a firing range with automatic weapons, you don't drown out a lot of shooting with weapons fire. So then you have to look for a different answer. And then when you have a policeman who tells his buddy, "Hey, it's really cool to shoot to a military marching music," right? You kind of then get a different perspective about the behavior or the mindset, but it comes from knowing, right? It comes from knowing what that sound is like. And I think sometimes this is where we have an advantage, those who have participated in that way, had that experience. And like you said, in other areas, we may be disadvantaged by the internal biases we have with respect to either the positive nature of camaraderie that sometimes clearly overshadows the negative side of that coin as well. So a lot to go with there.
Well, yeah. And I remember one of the things, examples of this was when I was researching the first book, and I'm reading, a memorandum that's been, some staff officer has written about, reminding soldiers they need to be tough or hard when it comes to, civilians and stuff like that, and, the military is not always the most rational organization, but rarely do people publish orders or guidances if there's not something to it, right? Either something that they want to prevent which means there's something that is happening, or there's something they want to promote, right? So clearly, for example, in that example, it meant that somebody was thinking that the soldiers were not being tough enough, and so therefore, they needed to do it. Or the dumber but funnier example is I was reading documents from the SS Cavalry Regiment in Eastern Europe in Russia, and there was a line in one of these memorandums of the day, which was SS troopers are forbidden from fishing with hand grenades. And it's like, you don't put that in there unless SS troopers are fishing with hand grenades, right? And then if you then extrapolate that out to some of the more important things that we'll talk about, the ways in which people are expected to behave, they become more serious, but equally enlightening, because militaries don't usually put those kinds of things in writing unless there's a problem they're trying to address, or a behavior that they're trying to reinforce or prevent, right? So I mean, I think that's another place where it sort of becomes second nature when I was reading this stuff, because I've written similar things, not about killing people, but similar prohibitions about dumb things that soldiers can do, and they're not supposed to do it. I've written that as a staff officer, and I'm sure you've seen that as well. So I mean, it does, living in that environment, I think, does help it from a certain perspective, just recognize things that someone, someone who didn't could recognize, but it might not be as easy for them, right? But maybe we should get to the specifics, I guess, because you've kind of mentioned a little bit, and this is, as always, our podcasts are not sort of book reviews, but they're things inspired by. And the book that we're sort of focusing on here, though, I think there's other parts of your work, I think, that are really interesting as well, we might talk about, is called Drunk on Genocide. And, it uses alcohol as a framing element. But I think it does way more than that as well, by talking about sort of the framework structures and behaviors around mass killing. So can you tell us, how did you come across this topic, and maybe why alcohol as the sort of entry point to this discussion?
Yeah, it was kind of like a development over time. So it actually, the original idea popped into my head from teaching. And when I roll over, I teach my Holocaust course every spring. And so I'd like to change the books for the students on a fairly regular basis. So in that rotation over a couple of years, I had had, of course, Chris Browning's Ordinary Men, which talks about the way these policemen used alcohol as kind of a coping mechanism largely. And then I was reading, I had Father Dubois' Holocaust by Bullets, where you have witnesses talking about the perpetrator's use of alcohol, actually in pretty great detail, and their behaviors. And then Wendy Lauer's book, Hitler's Furies, was one of the books I used. And there's quite a discussion of this kind of celebratory behavior and alcohol use in that book as well. And so what really struck me, so this was literally the week before spring break, I think in 2015. And I said, you know, this is a topic that really I would like to explore. How did the perpetrators use alcohol? So I sat down and I wrote for spring break. I wrote an article, which became the article that appeared in Holocaust and Genocide Studies in 2016, the Stone Cold Killers or Drunk with Murder, looking at how alcohol was used. And that was kind of the entree into this topic. But what I soon realized was that as I was kind of developing the idea for the book, was that it's not just about literal intoxication. It's not about just drinking. There's a metaphorical intoxication that Wendy's book also talks about, this idea of Ostrausch, the Eastern high or imperial high that German forces get in occupation. So the idea of the control of the land and bodies of others is an intoxication that happens. And as I continued to work through this, I also really identified this idea of the role of masculinity. And so Thomas Kuhne has done some really good work with that. Sven Reichert and some other historians have looked at masculinity in particular. And it was very clear to me that these perceptions of masculinity among these groups, especially among the SS and policemen that I was looking at, and to a certain degree as well in these ethnic auxiliaries in the East and the Wehrmacht, was something that helped also to add another aspect to their behavior that one could really start to disentangle. And those tied oftentimes to drinking rituals and to performative masculinity, performing against other men in this case. So the genesis of the book, which started with that first article, really just at looking at how alcohol was used, then really continued to evolve and to think about different types of intoxication, how camaraderie and masculinity then also helped to inform the actions of the perpetrators that I was looking at. So that's kind of where the book and how the book developed over a course of about 5 years.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe a good starting point is literally, what is the Nazi attitude towards alcohol, right? Because, you know, some of our more informed listeners, you know, might know that, you know, Himmler was notoriously a teetotaler, and Hitler also to a certain extent, right? But yet you also have this, as you point out, you know, this raucous drinking, you know, side of everything else. And how do we sort of join those things together, perhaps? And then is there a different sort of Nazi relationship to alcohol than a German relationship to alcohol, which I think is another question.
I think that's a great question to start with, because there's you know, when we talk about the Third Reich, you and I both know there's these huge paradoxes involved in the Third Reich, and alcohol is one of those, because Conti, who is a health minister in the Third Reich, Leonhard Conti, is pursuing what he calls the Getränkefrage, the drinking question. And the idea, at least from the Nazi health ministry, is the recognition that alcohol and tobacco are things that that hurt individuals' health. And so they want to limit that. So you have this public, if you will, this public campaign within the old Germany, within the Altreich itself, that's aimed at limiting alcohol and tobacco usage. And it is also has punitive measures. So about 30,000 individuals in Nazi Germany will be sterilized, forcibly sterilized on the diagnosis of chronic alcoholism, for example, right? They're seen as, quote, asocials. So you have this kind of, that's the public facing. And for Himmler, you mentioned him, it's also very interesting. He comes up through these German student fraternities, the so-called Burschenschaften, and he's a member of that, but he can't really handle his alcohol well. So he has to get a drinking dispensation. That really informs, he's a lightweight is what we would say in contemporary terms. He can't drink. Whereas some of these members of these Burschenschaften, they drink 1,000 liters of beer a year and they keep track, right? That kind of performative masculinity. So it's part of that culture. If you will. But the way that Himmler sees alcohol use for his policemen and his SS men is he recognizes that when they're involved in the duties, especially the duties in the East after the war starts, but even in the concentration camps, he comes up with the idea for the SS of these fellowship evenings that especially after major killing actions, he wants his guys to come together, not to talk about what they were involved in, but to do things like read poetry, listen to music, sing songs, believe it or not, all these kind of group building kind of ideas. And he mentions specifically in the orders for these fellowship evenings that you should drink one half liter of beer or two beers, no more than that, right? He kind of lays that down. He doesn't want these to become these kind of debauched drunk fests, and he doesn't actually want tobacco to be involved in them either. But what we see, the reality, and this is the difference from what the higher headquarters, if you will, in Berlin is saying the standard should be to what we actually, the behaviors we see in the field, is that they very much oftentimes become these kind of Sauforgien, literally drinking orgies, where these guys are just throwing it back and they are talking about what they were involved in. For some of the Einsatzgruppen, not only are they talking about what they're involved in, they're dividing some of the loot that they took that day as well at some of these post-celebratory kind of get-togethers. And one of the things that really struck me in looking at the rhetoric versus reality of this subject is a Polish waitress, a young woman who remembers, and she gives her testimony after the war about how these SS units would come in several times a week. And it was clear that they're coming back from shooting activities, and how they would drink, eat, and sing in the restaurant. And she talks also about how sometimes they would do like chariot races. So they would put each other in chairs and they'd race around the table against each other. And then after drinking a while, she then also talks about how she had to be very careful because the guys would try to grab her and she had to kind of make an escape from the restaurant in that way, not to be assaulted. And so if you look at that staging, if you will, of how these men are coming back, and as she said, several times a week, this would happen, it gives us a really different perspective on how these men are thinking about what they're involved in. And the way in which I think masculinity comes through in this is also the idea that a policeman coming back from a killing to his base, he likes a German secretary that's there. And for most of us, we would think, okay, this is up close personal killing, that this guy is going to be covered with the blood and body matter of his victims. And we would think that the first thing he would do is want to take a shower before visiting that secretary. But in fact, he wants to go show her how tough he is and goes in there wearing that uniform. So we kind of get insights since we can't look into the perpetrators' minds. I think what really is fascinating about this topic is the behaviors allow us to kind of really get a hold of and think about what the perpetrators are thinking in a way that maybe we wouldn't get to if we weren't using some of this kind of like the lens of masculinity, or looking at this celebratory ritual that's part of some of these killings. So I think that's really a key insight in the paradox of alcohol use. Like you said, Hitler's a teetotaler, but you know, I talk about my students, free history for 100. This is free history for 100. Hitler drinks at the beer hall putsch in November 1923. He's still a drinker. When he gives up alcohol and meat is actually at his time at Landsberg. So that's when he becomes really a vegan and a non-drinker. So he talks about how that he felt better about his health after that. And as you mentioned, Himmler's a lightweight. He smokes tobacco. He definitely smokes cigars. I've got pictures of him doing that. But he doesn't drink in the way that I talk about the SS and policemen. It's not in that really masculine way. So you see this regime that is often riven by these paradoxes. And there's one story, if you don't mind, I just want to keep with these paradoxes, because one of the things that struck me in writing the book was at Auschwitz, a lot of people may not know that it was actually an SS game preserve as well. So the surrounding area, they had an SS man who had the additional duty of being the game warden. And if you wanted to shoot a deer or a fox at the at Auschwitz, you needed to get a permit from the game warden. And so I have this case of an SS man who's shooting at a fox, actually hits a deer and kills the deer, and is punished, literally punished, for killing a deer without a permit. And all that SS guard needed during the day to kill a Jew was a pretext, right? And so we see these horrific kind of ironies in that system. And that's just another example of a horrific irony, that you need a pretext to kill a person, but you need a permit to shoot a deer at Auschwitz.
Well, yeah, I remember, you know, there's something I want to go back to, but I remember also I read an incident in the Soviet Union where, you know, an SS guy had, you know, shot a bunch of people. And he got in trouble, not because he'd shot them, but because he basically left them lying by the side of the road. And, you know, that was deemed to be, you know, problematic for whatever reason. And he hadn't cleaned up his mess or whatnot. But I want to go back to something you said that I think is really insightful, and something that I've noticed as well, because, you know, you're working on perpetrators, and this book, in some ways, I think in a lot of ways, is somewhat about motivation and sort of what is driving these people. And we can't, it's very difficult as historians to parse this, because almost always we can't actually interview them. And a lot of the sort of ego documents that we have from them, you know, I know the ones that you used and the ones that I use, well, a lot of them come from court cases. And so you already have a we'll call it a problematic environment in which the person is testifying, which doesn't mean that what they're saying, that some of what they're saying isn't true, but it's obviously a sort of confrontational environment. And there's a very clear interest for them to sort of play down certain things and play up other things. And I agree 100%. I think what you said was really, really important, which is that in the absence of being able to literally put them on the couch and sort of ask them how they felt and that kind of thing, all we have is their behavior. And we have to then kind of extrapolate, you know, what is a reasonable explanation for their mindset based on how they're behaving, which is, you know, not always a 100% accurate methodology, but it's all we have, right? So can you talk a little bit about how alcohol is used in these various places? Because I think there's also an important there are a series of important geographical distinctions that you make as well in your work, right? We have camps, sort of general camps, we'll say, not the extermination centers. We have the extermination centers, and then we also have sort of these mass shootings, Einsatzgruppen kinds of behaviors, as well as ghettos. So that there's two layers of questioning there. Like, one is sort of, what do the behaviors suggest about how the perpetrators are feeling, thinking about what they're doing? And then maybe how does the geography matter, or does it in these scenarios?
Yeah, I think that's a great question to deal with, and I do want to also mention something about getting into the minds of the perpetrators first, because you are absolutely right, Waitman. We deal with these court cases. Sometimes we're lucky with the ego documents. We get letters where, you know, the Einsatzgruppen, and whether it's Kretschmer's letters back to his wife and his children, or Landau's diary, or, you know, different things. But one of the things that I was most struck by is, you know, recently, in the last 10, 15 years, we've really started to focus on, hey, we don't want to just get the perpetrator's perspective, but what's the victim and eyewitness perspective? And that was a big turn in Holocaust historiography, to get away essentially from a focus on the German documents to look also at these other areas that the victim's experience. And one of the things that really struck me in that respect was what became known as Horbansprach, the destruction language, which was a Yiddish variant that is created during the Shoah. So as these SS and police units, as these German military units are moving into East European towns and villages, the people that live in those villages are trying to interpret what the killers are doing, what the perpetrators are doing, and they're looking for a language to do it. And the language they choose, for example, is things like using a wedding metaphor or a ball, a gala, right? And so they're using this Yiddish language that translates to those terms. And when I read that, it was kind of a eureka moment for me. Because as I was thinking about, if we're in Eastern Europe in this time period in a small village, what's going to be essentially the most celebratory day in the year of a hardworking small community? It's going to be a wedding, because there's going to be music, there's going to be food, there's going to be drink, and there's going to be celebration. And when I put that, when I kind of thought about that, at taking the victims and the witnesses at their word, they were seeing, they're interpreting what the perpetrators are as a wedding atmosphere, right? So they're using that language to describe the behavior of the perpetrators, just like many talk about the amusement or the enjoyment or the laughter and the kind of laughter that the perpetrators demonstrated when they were involved in these actions. And I think that, for me, that was really a moment where I said, I really have to take seriously the words that the victims are using, because that's their interpretation of the reality that they're seeing. So I think that was really a key point in my own kind of development of some of these ideas. But to get back to the idea of geography and how alcohol is used, differently, I think Donald Bloxham's Zones of Exception really is a great way of talking about, before the war, talking about the camps, because the camps under SS control, especially, they become these kind of, if you will, sites of exception where the law outside doesn't apply. The SS essentially has complete control over the bodies of those individuals who are in those camps. And what really struck me as I was looking at the pre-war, period here, is how these SS men, oftentimes at night, the central role of the SS canteen, which would be the kitchen and the bar for these SS men, how they would having like fellowship and drinking or eating, and either decide to go into the camp area, the barracks, to kind of, if you will, humiliate or play games with the prisoners, and or how they would have prisoners brought into the canteen and make them perform or humiliate them there, right? These rituals of humiliation or games that are played with the victims, oftentimes under the influence of alcohol, where it would generate, if you will, this kind of facilitation towards acts of violence or atrocity, I think was really one of those areas that that really stuck in my mind. And that kind of behavior is after 1939, when we look at the geography of the East, the especially occupied Poland, the areas in the Baltics, the Balkans. I think we can take the whole East, in this case, occupied Soviet Union as well. That we see these behaviors are also exhibited in these areas, which are themselves a zone of exception. So one of the things you mentioned earlier is Himmler has to repeatedly order his SS and policemen not to take pictures, not to take photographs of killings. Well, why does he have to repeatedly issue that order? Because he knows that the guys are doing it anyway. And just in the case of alcohol, he has to repeatedly issue orders about, hey, these get-togethers aren't to be drunk fests. You're not supposed to be drinking on duty. So there's one order for Minsk in particular, where the order has to be repeated every week. And in Auschwitz, we also see these the orders coming out of the Auschwitz administration, where they're talking about not alcohol use on duty time, avoiding, for example, methyl alcohol, all these things. So what we're seeing is that the reason you've got to have these orders is because the guys are doing it. And then some of the behaviors that are coming out of these kinds of situations are the behaviors of physical violence that can lead to playing games. So I know your work, which I'm really excited about, on the Yanovska camp. You know, you have cases where you have shooting competitions between SS men. And so you have the idea is a prisoner is forced to hold a glass up in his hand. And the two policemen then, or two SS men in this case, their object is who can shoot the glass out of the prisoner's hand to demonstrate their superior marksmanship, right? And if the glass is shot out of the hand of the prisoner, then that guy wins, and that's good. If he happens to hit the hand of the prisoner, then the prisoner is executed because he's no longer capable of work. So using prisoners as a prop for performative masculinity, it happens in Yanovska, but it happens in Auschwitz. The idea that for a bet, for a bottle of vodka, a guy will bet that he can shoot a prisoner in the neck from 50 meters using his pistol to demonstrate his marksmanship. These kinds of games that are incorporated in really horrific kinds of games in some cases. The idea of using, you know, children. There's one I talk about in the book where the object of the game, as explained to the policeman, is you take a child, a young child, and you have to throw them in the air over like 20 meters or so. And the object of the game is for the child to hit their head on this tree trunk to where it essentially kills the child. And then you get a shot. You get a shot of booze if you're able to do that. But this kind of behavior that is also often associated with drinking in these locations, I think really opens up and complicates our view of the way in which alcohol is used. Now, the main theme, if you look at the historiography before this book came out, of alcohol use was really about coping. And certainly coping does take place. And Chris Browning's book, Ordinary Men, really talks about how PB 101, how at the end of the day that many of these guys seek kind of refuge in alcohol. And that's certainly something that does happen. But what I saw in the historiography is if people really talked too much about alcohol, I mean, really got into discussing it, it would normally be either a sentence or a paragraph where the discussion would pretty much be, and the only way that they could do this was to drink. And the more and more I kept looking for that bottle in the haystack, as I talked about it. I found a lot of bottles in the haystack, by the way. And the more I saw that, that explanation needed complication, because it certainly wasn't the case for these SS men who, it's December 31st of 1942, and they're celebrating like many of us may be on a New Year's Eve this year by drinking and having a party. But what is it they decide to do after the clock strikes 12? They decide to go into a ghetto in occupied Poland to hunt Jews. And the survivor who talks about it remembers these drunken guys who were doing it as kind of like a sport in the ghetto. So what did those guys have to decide? They'd been drinking, celebrating. It's the new year. What's the thing they wanted to do to start the new year? It was to go into a ghetto and kill Jews. And I think, again, those kinds of behaviors, you know, that really does complicate our understanding of alcohol use and these guys and their behaviors there. So those are several, I think, of the things that I noticed. And to your point, I think it's really important to understand that alcohol serves a variety of functions. So coping is one. It's also a reward and incentive for the killers. It's used in that way. It facilitates acts of violence, as I talked about. There's also the idea of what I call disinhibition. What I tell my students is the so-called spring break effect. And what I mean by that is that alcohol, drinking alcohol, allows someone to cross a threshold to do something. And in the case of some of the killers, killing women and children was a threshold activity that alcohol would help them kind of cross that threshold. And the reason I use the spring break effect is because when I'm talking to my students to give them an example of what I mean, it's the idea that when you go down to Daytona Beach and you check in your hotel and you've got a third floor balcony that overlooks the pool and it's 10 a.m. in the morning, you're going like, wow, I've got a great room. This is a great view of the beach. But then at midnight that night, after maybe having too much to drink, you know, when you're back in the room with your buddies and one of them says, you know, I bet you could reach the pool from this balcony. I bet you could jump into the pool. You know, all of a sudden now, right, that becomes, oh yeah, I think you're right, right? And that's that disinhibition that alcohol can cause. And it's also a little bit of that performative masculinity. Yeah, you're right, I can do it. I'm going to show you I can do it. So again, trying to make some of these processes, you know, understandable in those terms, I think is important. And the last thing, if I could say on this, which I think is really important, I think you and I both agree that social sciences offer us as historians a lot of powerful insights that we might not otherwise get from the documents we look at. And one of the things that was really important to me as I was doing the book was looking at how psychology, criminology, sociology, how that literature related to alcohol use and related to alcohol and aggression. The studies that have been done, whether it's you know, university fraternities or rugby teams or whatever, that we also start to get insights into the way that in which male bonding and alcohol use can lead to acts of violence, both physical violence but sexual violence, as you talked about earlier as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that really struck me in this conversation as well is. And something that I noticed, because, and again, this is not about the Inovska book, but one of the challenges that I had when I was writing that was trying to explain some of these things that you've mentioned, because to me, and again, it's all sort of relative and qualitative, but you know, some of the things they were doing seemed really, really just above and beyond in terms of the brutality and the sadism and things like this. And the shooting is something that I go into in some detail in the book. And one of the suggestions that I make there is that, I'd be curious what your response is, because this is something that we see elsewhere, is that there's a sort of inferiority complex for the SS and the police that are engaged in murdering civilians as compared to the Wehrmacht or the Waffen-SS that are actually fighting, right? Because we know that one of the things that Nazi masculinity privileges is fighting, combat, you know, and that kind of thing. And these guys aren't doing that, and they know they're not doing that. And they know that they're sort of, that they have kind of a cushy existence that is safe. And so it seemed to me that one explanation, and the alcohol might play into this as well, for why they do things like the shooting, which is a very sort of martial demonstration of masculinity, is to kind of pretend like they're actually soldiers doing actual soldier things, which is, you know, marksmanship and that kind of thing. And perhaps the hunting too, because you have a really chilling example in the book of literally the SS taking prisoners, Jews, out into the woods and saying run, and then hunting them down. You know, I just that struck me as well. But I wonder if there's also this an attempt to sort of sell that we are also fighting a war. You know, we're just fighting a war on a different front, but we're fighting this sort of this racial war.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. When I think about especially some of the killing sites, if we also look at the Reinhardt camps, right, for example, we see this really brutalized behavior. I know you had Martin Cooper's on the podcast earlier, and the Sobibor album, right? One of the things that when I talk about this, when I give this presentation on the book, I have now included photos from Sobibor, and many of those photos are focused around that canteen, the SS canteen, the casino that's there, right? And you see these guys sitting, playing music, you know, women serving them, Polish or Ukrainian women who are serving them. Then the way in which they're at this location, enjoying that location, but to think, you know, maybe 500 meters away is the site of mass killing, and the smell that we know is oftentimes in that, you know, that permeates that area, right? To think about how these guys are in a social scene, kind of enjoying that social scene, is really, to me, kind of another striking way to think about what's going on in those sites of killing. But I do think that the men, especially in those camps, they definitely realize that they're not in the front line. And I wonder, you know, you get every once in a while that some of them don't want to go to the front line, right? That's what happens when you screw up at Auschwitz. You get sent to, you know, you get sent to the front line, that somehow they're taking advantage of that, as you will, as you talked about this, this kind of cushy job in their perspective, where they're at. But I do think that, you know, again, their self-perception is built on first being an SS man. It's not being an SS man in combat. And, you know, policemen, one of the Ten Commandments of the German police is you are a bearer of a firearm, right? And I think this is, again, something that we sometimes forget, that the idea that men could carry, that these men could carry a firearm and use it, means a lot to them in the way they think about themselves and how they're seen as well. And so, you know, their ability to use that firearm and their willingness to use it, I think, is part of that kind of culture that develops. And then you get on top of that, this belief in themselves as being tough and hard men, able to do these things. It's like the Max Teubner, who was an SS lieutenant, who actually gets tried, and I could talk a little bit about that. But he's a guy that boasts he's going to be in an SS logistics unit, so he's not going to be on the front lines. But he's talking about how he's going to the east and he's going to kill 20,000 Jews. That's his goal. He talks about it. He brings his accordion and he plays his accordion, you know, at some of the killing sites for the men, right? And what gets him into trouble is not the fact that his unit's involved in killing, but the fact that he sends the film home to his wife to have it developed commercially of some of the pictures that he took at one of these killing sites. And then the investigation also shows that he had his wife have an abortion, and which is for the SS, you know, a huge no-no. And so this guy ends up really getting into trouble and imprisoned, not because of the killing he was involved in, but really for the things that he allowed it to kind of seep out, and the fact that his wife had the abortion. And so it shows this what I'm trying to get at here is how this SS mentality is so warped, right? That when we understand that, just like the idea of you need the permit to kill a fox, but a pretext to kill a Jew, it shows an internal mentality that is so warped it gives us kind of an insight into the way they still think about themselves. Now, for these guys to wear a Knight's Cross or an Iron Cross, I agree, you know, to have that, to have these military decorations does mean something. And it is important to note that the men in the concentration camps aren't getting Iron Crosses. They're getting the German War Cross, right? Which is a non-combat, normally a non-combat kind of decoration. So there is a distinguishing that's taking place in the way they're being evaluated. I guess I really I don't know how much they're compensated. I'm really struggling with thinking about how much of it's a compensatory rhetoric, you know, a compensatory mechanism, as to how much of it is just part of the idea. And as we both know, you know, these SS units and the police units that go into anti-partisan operations, right? Essentially, they're used as infantry. You know, they fight on the front lines. And as you've talked about in your work on Mogilev and others, right, that the idea that Jews become partisans in the mind of Himmler, in the mind of the SS and the police, and they're executed as such. But when you see you read the after action reports, you know, yeah, X number of partisans, hundreds of partisans were executed. And then they'll tell you, oh, they're women and children. How many of them were women and children? And five weapons were confiscated. So immediately, as you're reading that document, you know that the partisan, it's a fictive euphemism, right, for mass slaughter in this case. So, you know, I just think that the idea, the normalization of murder within the SS and police complex, for me, is really the thing that sticks in my mind, how normalized it becomes and how easy in many cases it becomes. And I'll give you one more example. Walter Manna, who was an Austrian policeman, we have his letters to his wife. And he writes to his wife the night before his first killing action. And he tells her he's been issued with 28 rounds of pistol ammunition. And he says to her, I'm not sure it's going to be enough. And so we have a subsequent letter where he's writing to his wife about having been in the action. And he talks at the beginning. He says, you know, my hands were shaking the first couple of groups. But he says by the 10th group, his hands weren't shaking anymore, and he's able to do it. And he adds to his wife that he becomes involved in that killing game that I talked about throwing the children I think, again, right, that how long did it take him to make that transition from the first to the 10th group is what it took. And these are the kinds of really kind of shocking things about this kind of hanging in the group, showing that you can do what the other guys can do, that you're tough enough. That to me really kind of exemplifies the way in which these men kind of see themselves or want to be seen by their comrades. That's, you know, again, a long way around the mountain to get to your question, but that's kind of where I come to.
Well, and one of the things that comes through, I think, really strongly in what you've written, and you've already mentioned some here already, is what I would call the intimacy of the violence, you know, because there's one level of intimacy, which is just, you know, a row of people is placed in front of me, I shoot them, a row of people is placed in front of me, I shoot them, or I take people to the gas chamber or whatnot. But when one is as inventive and imaginative about all the different ways, even just the physicality of having to, you know, cut someone's hair or whatnot, it's a really interesting, not a revelation, but I mean, it's a very interesting perspective that may not sort of have a certain logical rationality in it, in the sense that, you know, on the one hand, we like to think that these are people that they thought were horrendous and inferior, which is true. But yet they're also getting very intimately connected with them. You know, they are placing themselves voluntarily in close proximity, you know, having to hold someone down. And in one instance, you mentioned to carve a swastika in someone. I mean, these are physically very intimate and close range kinds of behaviors. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think it's fascinating that you sort of, you have this amongst people that one would imagine on the surface would just be repulsed and would not want to have them anywhere near them.
Yeah. And again, this I think is an important point, because when we hear about prisoners being given 25 strokes or 50 strokes as a beating, we think about, as we should, how that must affect the prisoner that's being beaten like that. But to deliver 25 or 50 strokes with a whip or a rod on the part of the person doing that, that takes a great deal of physical effort and commitment on the part of the person that's abusing that individual. And what I noticed several times is how you would also see in the camps how guards and how prisoners would remember how the guards would attempt to outdo each other, compete against each other. Who can deliver the best beating? And I talk in the book about how some of these guards like to get their nicknames. One's called the boxer, right? And there are many SS guards that have the nickname boxer. And in this one case of the individual I talk about, though, what he prides himself on is the ability to stand across from a prisoner and with one blow of his fist to knock a prisoner out, right? And that's something he practices. That's something he wants to demonstrate in front of his buddies that he's doing that. And, you know, we also see that can cross gender lines. So Braunstein, who was a female concentration camp guard, I believe at Ravensbrück, gets her nickname the Mare. You know, like the mare as in a horse, because she tramples prisoners to death, which is a very physically tiring and difficult way to kill somebody. But she prides herself on her ability to do that. And I talk in the book about a case where an SS man is delivering these blows, this punishment blows to a prisoner, and a female SS guard takes the whip out of his hand and says, "You're not doing it right." And she begins then to beat the prisoner. And what really struck me when I came across that, and we talked about zones of exception in the camp, right? The idea that we have in Nazi Germany, very defined gender roles of what men are and men do and what women should do, you know, have children, take care of the home, right? But this is again where the camp for women can be a zone of exception, where this woman, she is not, she's rejecting that kind of traditional gender role for a woman in Nazi Germany, and she's adopting the gender role of the male SS man and trying to do him better, right? And so I think, again, this is an example in my mind where I was like, okay, wow, this is showing me how this mindset of hardness and toughness it can even cross genders in certain places, where Wendy talks about Erna Petrie. She's infamous, notorious for finding these Jewish children who were obviously roaming near her estate in the East in Ukraine. And what she does is she wants to wait for her husband to come home because she knows that they're going to be killed. She gives them food and her husband's not home. And so what does she decide to do? she decides to go ahead and shoot the kids herself in the area where her husband normally executes these people that are found wandering on the state, these Jewish children or Jewish people who have escaped. And it was only during her incarceration in East Germany, this eventually comes out for different reasons, she and her husband are investigated by the East German police, and they're put through a long series of interrogations. But finally, she admits to the East German interrogator, "Why did you do that? Why did you kill those kids?" And she says, "I didn't want to stand behind the men. I wanted to prove, right? I wanted to prove I was as tough as my husband. I was a real SS wife, if you will, in that case." And again, that's where the East is also that zone of exception. But we see how those kinds of mindsets, right, permeate these SS households in some cases, and the way in which they can be adopted by even women in certain cases.
And there's also, just in that example, there's this really interesting, I think, connection with this idea of settler colonialism, right? And that in this sense of like the Nazis viewing themselves as settlers in Eastern Europe, right? In many ways, I mean, like, I think about some of these places in the context of a plantation. I mean, you know, where the white slave owner can do whatever he wants to the enslaved people on his land, you know, because a plantation is also in some ways a zone of exception, certainly for the African-American people on it, right, who don't have the same rights or and are not viewed as humans in the same way, right? So there's also and I think that gets back to your original comment about sort of the intoxication of essentially, you know, being someone with no rules, whom rules don't apply to, right? And I think an example, which is not anywhere near this, but when after 9/11, right, I was at Fort Hood, and they locked down the entire base, and they put us all on gate guard, basically, right, because we weren't doing 100% ID checks for all 40,000 people coming on Fort Hood before 9/11. But afterwards we were, and they didn't have enough people. And one of the things I noted very quickly was soldiers and NCOs and some officers, you know, like there was a sense of power, right? You could stop any car. And so I had to stop soldiers from like repeatedly pulling over cars with like attractive women in them, you know? And I'd say, you just can't do this, right? I mean, this is wrong. But again, it's this, I mean, and obviously that is a tiny example compared to Nazi Germany, but I think the analogy holds, right? Where people are given sort of sweeping powers, and the tendency is very quickly to sort of get high off of that and abuse them for your own purposes.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and I, in addition to teaching the Holocaust, I teach the Civil War and Reconstruction. So what you mentioned, when we look at things of spectacular violence and celebratory violence, when we think about lynching, for example, in the Jim Crow South, for example, we have the way in which these scenes are commemorated, the people, men, women, and children that are there, sometimes food involved in this, right? So I do think that some of these attitudes that we see in the case of racial prejudice in our own country, in the U.S., and the way that played out, we can take some of that literature, and we can take some of those insights and think about the quote unquote racial state of Nazi Germany and how individuals in that state took advantage of a perception of racial superiority that allowed them to transgress and to become involved in violence. And, you know, if you go back to the WPA, slave narrative, so when the WPA was gathering in the 1930s, these slave narratives and former female slaves talking about the ubiquity of sexual violence against slave women, for example, that make it into those transcripts. You know, this is where, where we, if we think traditionally, many people go, well, number one, this was the racial defilement, Rassenschande, you know, these Germans weren't involved in sexual violence against, you know, Jewish women or Eastern women. And then we have, as Regina Mollhäuser and others have shown, you know, even the SS and police courts are estimating that 50% of SS and policemen have been involved in sexual, you know, what would be sexual violence or sexual relations with quote unquote inferior women. In this case, they're looking at Eastern women, Slavic women, or they're looking, you know, Jews. But the idea here is how widespread it is. And I think that that's, again, where Patrick Dubois' Holocaust by Bullets, you know, those witnesses in Ukraine who remember how these SS men took Jewish women as concubines. And then after they were done with them, you know, a period of days or weeks, then they execute them, right? So, again, what does that tell us about the perpetrator mindset, right? When we start to think about these men and what they're doing and those examples, you know, that's there's many examples from that. So I do think that it really does. This intoxication of control, metaphorical intoxication, is a very powerful force, you know, and despite its problems, the Zimbardo, you know, the standard Stanford prison experiment, you know, we see a little bit about that. It's problematic as, you know, in using that as a one for one. But there's certainly attitudes that develop in control over others that can lead to abuse, as we know.
Yeah, I mean, and the sexual violence piece is, I think, a really, you know, powerful example of that, because it's layers of violence. Because, you know, as you point out, that certainly, I think it's fair to say that the SS men engaging in that kind of sexual violence and assault knew that it was, from a Nazi perspective, wrong for the racial reasons, right? But because of their impunity in Eastern Europe, they knew they could kill the evidence, essentially. And they could remove the evidence by killing a human being, and that would not be, and everybody else is winking at it anyway. So it's not a thing you get in trouble for unless somebody else has it out for you for a different reason, and then that's the way they can sort of get you on that. I want one more question just before we sort of move on to the end. I was curious, because I think one of the things that you've said that I think is really insightful as well is this idea of the nature of the celebration, the nature of alcohol use in general, right? Because I think you're right, and I hadn't really thought about it that way, but that for a lot of time, the historiography is a little bit apologetic in the sense of thinking that, you know, these guys are just going and drinking themselves into oblivion, trying to forget what they've done. But what you've pointed out, I think, quite well, especially from survivors, you know, is that these are sort of celebratory events. So it's not, you know, that the survivor doesn't walk by and see all these guys like with their heads slumped, you know, doing shot after shot until they fall over because they just can't handle it. They're actually quite excited about it. So I'm curious if and I guess this is not a great question to ask historians because it's unfair, but could you give an estimate of sort of the percentages or extent to which, you know, these particular group of people are sort of all in and motivated sort of killers versus, you know, those who may be just sort of joining the crowd for the drinking, but maybe not be sort of as dedicated, if I suppose, because I guess one perspective could be that, well, these are the worst examples that you could find, but how representative are they, with the understanding that we're already talking about a specific group of people, not all Nazis or all Germans.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you asked that question, because one of the things that the book does is, as you'll notice, is there's lots of examples. And the reason some people have said, wow, man, you're really recounting just so much, you know, do you need that much detail? And my response to that is, yeah, I think I do. And the reason that I do is because the historiography has been so far in the other direction that to really bring this home, I've got to show you a lot of details. And of course, I don't put every case in there. You know, it'd be like the black book of the Jewish black book that shows all these investigations that were conducted. And if you read through that, those investigations, I mean, just horrific event after horrific event, right? It's hundreds of pages of stuff, right? So I did think it was important to include a lot of examples because I am arguing against, I think, a historiographical kind of belief in coping as being the primary mechanism. And I think this gets back, brings us almost full circle to where we started, actually. I think the reason it's a vice and a virtue that historians think that coping is the answer, because the virtue is we don't think like Nazis. And so as we're seeing these horrendous things, we're saying, well, of course, the only way anyone could do that is to be drunk. No, there's no other. You can't be sober and do that, right? And so it's kind of also like when we have guys like Friedrich Jaeckeln and others who are, you know, after the war or when we're looking at their correspondence, they have these trouble sleeping and they have stomach issues, right? And so what do a lot of historians want to do? Well, they want to say, well, that's psychosomatic reaction to them being involved in all these killings. This is their body rebelling against them. Well, if you look at the physiological effects of high alcohol use that I talk about, one of the symptoms is difficulty sleeping, poor sleep. And another one is like stomach and intestinal ulcers from the kind of drinking that we see. Now, what I'm not saying is that my answer is right and others have been wrong. But what I am saying that because we're not Nazis and because we want to have an explanation that helps us make these guys sound a little bit more like us, that we choose that, we choose the psychosomatic or we choose the coping. And I think that that's something that we really need to kind of move away from. But to finish back to your point, I think the power of the group is really important here. So what you see in the case of Kretschmer, who is part of the Einsatzgruppe, and as he's writing back to his wife and his kids, he mentions that post-killing that they like to play Scott. They like to play German card games together, and they drink afterwards. And he has this in his letter. He says, and one can't not be there, right? You need to be there. And just like we see in other cases where guys are talking about, if you tell the group, hey, tonight, guys, I'm not going to join you after the killing action. I'm not going to join you for beer or schnapps together. What the group interprets that as is not only are you rejecting their invitation to be part of the group, you're rejecting the actions that they were involved in that day as well, right? And that's where you get the, you know, the way in which, you know, people are called effeminized names, you know, weakling, mama's boy, Schlappschwanz, you know, in German, limp dick, these kind of things, the guys who can't measure up, if you will, to these standards. So I do think that peer pressure, which Chris's book, obviously, Ordinary Men talks about, it's a powerful thing. This idea of kind of what I look at as kind of genocidal camaraderie is an idea that I've been kind of working on here, how that camaraderie in these groups, not just Germans, but in other places, Rwanda, we see some of these manifestations of this as well. So I think that we see this in multiple places. So to get to a hard number, I think you're right. It's really going to be impossible. But I do think the key thing for me is to just again really start to complicate our understanding of these men in ways that help us maybe gain new insights into motivation that we otherwise wouldn't have had, and to kind of also question maybe some of the things that we accept now as truisms in that way as well.
Well, Ed, thank you so much for coming on. And I want to close with the question that I always ask our guests. which is if you could recommend one book on the Holocaust that you found, you know, important or meaningful to you, which one would it be?
Yeah, I think we've kind of hit on that a little bit already. And we both know Chris Browning very well. You worked with him at UNC, and I've known him for a long time. Ordinary Men, for those of us who do perpetrator studies, right, was really something that really opened the door and really made the topic. You know, social scientists like Jim Waller and Harald Welzer and others, you know, kind of came on board with that. But I think Chris's work is there. I do think one of the things that I would say, what I really liked about Wendy Lauer's book, Hitler's Furies, was, and what my students like, is they don't think about women as perpetrators. So thinking about genocidal societies, it's a society and it's genocidal. That crosses the line into men and women. But I guess I would also say that I don't think I've never not, so I'm going to do a double negative here. I've never not learned something new from reading a survivor's memoirs. And I know you've worked with Leon Wells's work, which I think is really a very powerful discussion of Yanofsky in ways. I think, you know, everyone here will be familiar with Knight, Elie Wiesel, Primo Levi's work, Richard Glaser's Trapped with a Green Fence, for example, Seed of Sarah, Judith Magyar Isaacson, Olga Lyniell's Five Chimneys. And I know I'm throwing a lot in there, but I do think it's really important that the voices of those who participated, Charlotta Delbo after Auschwitz, those who were there, really, I think I could read those books 50 times in a given year, and I'd still find new insights every time I went back into them. So I do think that that's extremely important, that the voices of the survivors are something that's really represented in the way we talk about what's important for Holocaust historiography.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I'll second that as well. You know, for our listeners, you know, it's also important, essentially, not to let the perpetrators have the last word, I suppose, in a way of thinking, you know, not taking. And I think the scholarship has been trying to move in this direction for a long time. You know, Saul Friedlander's idea of it, or basically, you know, challenge that we need to write an integrated history that, you know, uses all perspectives. Right. I think is really important. And it's always a good reminder, you know, that just because they may have been victims or may have been on the victimized side doesn't mean that those people don't have insights to tell us, or that their descriptions, their memories, or their recollections and their interpretations of behavior at the time aren't correct either, right? So I think that's a really great way to sort of finish it off. For everyone else, as always, please, if you are finding this podcast to be interesting, useful, thought-provoking, please leave a rating and a comment. Those are all great things to help us as far as the metrics go. And I will put in the show notes links to Professor Westerman's books, as well as, obviously, always to the book he's recommended. And lastly, of course, remember that there is a link to all of the books that all of our guests have recommended on my website under the Holocaust History Podcast webpage. Ed, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Waitman. It was great talking to you and great to reconnect with you. And congratulations on your latest work, too.